Ladies and gentlemen, before we commence on our deliberations this evening, I would like to advise you that in the next week or so, we're going to start construction on the new hospital, and there'll be some dislocation with respect to parking outside. However, there will be traffic wardens here to advise you, so don't be scared away. Come as before, and people will guide you to your proper parking area. And next Saturday, particularly, I'd like to have you attend. There's a chap who I'm vaguely connected with who's going to speak to us. His name is Eric Vogt. It's my great pleasure and the courtesy of the Green Foundation that we are privileged to present to you tonight, Dr. Eberhard Bethke. To say that Dr. Bethke, as the program announces, has firsthand knowledge of the totalitarian state of Nazi Germany is something of an understatement. Dr. Bethke was a student in 1934 when he was expelled from the Theological College at Wittenberg because he refused obedience to the Nazi Reichsbishop. In 1935, he joined the anti-Nazi Confessing Church Seminary in Finkenwald, where Dietrich Bonhoeffer was director, and until 1940, when the seminary was finally closed by the Nazis, Bethke served as Bonhoeffer's assistant and became close friends. In 1944, he was arrested and imprisoned by the Nazis. And this was a year and a half after Dietrich Bonhoeffer himself had been arrested. In 1945, Dr. Bethke was freed by the Russians when they entered Berlin, and after the war served in Berlin as an assistant to Bishop Debelius and as student chaplain. From 1945 on, he was pastor of a German congregation in London, and then visiting lecturer in theology at Harvard Divinity School. From 1961 until 1975, he has been director of the Institute for Continuing Education for Clergy of the Evangelical Church in the Rhineland. From 66 to 67, he was visiting professor at the Chicago Theological Seminary, and from 76 to 77, visiting scholar of the University Ministries of Broadway Presbyterian Church and visiting professor at the Union Theological Seminary in New York City. He's received honorary doctorates from the University of Glasgow, the Theological Faculty of Humboldt University in Berlin, and from the University of Bern in Switzerland. Dr. Bethke has edited the works of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and he's written a biography which has been translated into English of the great Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and has published several volumes of essays and articles. I have great pleasure in presenting to you Dr. Eberhard Bethke, who will talk about Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the totalitarian state.
Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a German churchman, German theologian and companion of Karl Barth, and at the same time, in the last part of the Third Reich, a member of the conspiracy, had started to write an ethic out of his own Lutheran tradition and in a way against his own Lutheran tradition. In ethic for Christians in his particular German world of those days, grounded in a faith on the given presence of Christ. In the fragments of this ethic, there comes a highly theological paragraph about the doctrine of incarnation and the function of this doctrine. And there Bonhoeffer refers to the phenomenon of both human contempt of man and of human idolizing of man, Menschenverachtung und Menschenvergötzung. Both spring forth from the same root, namely from the contempt of love of God to the real human being. And both lead to the same condition, namely the tyrannically suppressed society put under tutelage. Reading those pages, you suddenly are confronted with a formidable portrait of Adolf Hitler, of course, without giving the name. This paragraph was written exactly in early autumn of 1940, shortly after Hitler's greatest victory over France, and when his popularity with the Germans was most irresistible because of that unexpected victory. And there Bonhoeffer meditates. I quote, "The tyrannical despiser of man exploits easily the baseness of the human heart, nurturing it and calling it by other names. Human weaknesses are played upon with unchaste seductiveness, so that meanness and baseness are reproduced and multiplied ever anew. As the base man grows baser, he becomes an ever more willing and adaptable tool in the hand of the tyrant." And later on, these sentences, to which I might then later refer, quote goes on, "He thinks people stupid and they become stupid. He thinks them weak and they become weak. He thinks them criminal and they become criminal." About 2 years later, at Christmas time, 42, Bonhoeffer addressed the same theme, the same phenomenon of putting someone under the tutelage in a totalitarian state, making him stupid again. This time, though not in a paragraph about a venerable Christian doctrine, written for these doctrinal paragraphs in the ethics written for fellow experts, now in a short essay meant for some of his own members of his family and non-theological co-conspirators. These friends who were threatened by their simple fatigue, by their complicated deliberations, whether people would fall in with their support once the putsch against Hitler would have started or not. That whole essay called After 10 Years, considering that these men, like Dietrich himself, was in the beginning of their 30s, had been pressed the theme to handle with all the last 10 years, were not able to choose their life theme themselves, asking themselves, was that now a lost time? And Dietrich saying to his friends in the conspiracy and to the members of his family, no, this was not a lost time. And now in this essay comes a paragraph again about stupidity. This problem apparently was a tantalizing problem for these men in the conspiracy. They had to do very much with the problem of power, but of course too with the problem whether other people in Germany would fall in, would support them if the plot would go on, would start. I quote from this, "Stupidity is more a dangerous enemy to the good than evil. Against stupidity we have no defense. Neither protests nor force can touch it. Reasoning is of no use. Facts that contradict personal prejudices can simply be disbelieved. later. It seems then that stupidity is a sociological rather than a psychological problem, and that it is a special form of the operation of historical circumstances on people, a psychological byproduct of definite external forces. Looking more closely, we see that any violent display of power, whether political or religious, produces an outburst of stupidity in a large part of mankind. Einen großen Teil der Menschen schlägt es mit Dummheit in German. Indeed, it goes on, this seems actually to be a psychological and sociological law. The power of some needs the stupidity of the others. And you realize already how Dietrich tries to say to his colleagues in the conspiracy, don't talk all the time about this problem. It is a fact of external power. First, that power must be put away. And so the quotation goes on later. It is quite clear that stupidity can be overcome not by instruction, but only by an act of liberation. And so we have to come to terms with the fact that in the great majority of cases, inward liberation must be preceded by outward liberation. And that until that has taken place, we may as well abandon all attempts to convince the stupid one. And that had very practical reasons in those days for his and his group. And then the last sentence where Dietrich feels a little bit, might be to be a little elitist what I say, he closes that paragraph, I quote, but there's some consolation in these thoughts on stupidity. They in no way justify us in thinking that most people are stupid in all circumstances. What will really matter is whether those in power expect more from people's stupidity than from their wisdom and from their independence of mind. In this context, I like to remember that Boniface's analysis of stupidity, which now, as he says, is caused by political and by religious superpowers, that this did not come out of an experience with people from uneducated or ungifted background. In the contrary, behind this analysis, we find his family's and his friends' experience just with the intellectuals of his class, including, of course, with the leaders of his church. The experience with extraordinary efficient civil servants, professors, experts, generals, bishops, who were so well known all over the world for their Tüchtigkeit, their excellency in their professional fields, as we are now again. And it were just these who showed themselves as, to a great part, so weak links in the chain of any resistance against the progressing tutelage of all sectors of life in Hitler's state. And we might remember, Hitler was by far the most effective of all the fascist leaders because he had the best field experts at his hands and could use them because of a long and partly, of course, Lutheran education for limiting your work and responsibilities to the boundaries of your own profession and not to look into other men's business and affairs. I think, for instance, of Albert Speer, that rather sympathetic and able technician who remained apolitical, not realizing how political our apolitical attitudes are all the time and again will be. And who, Speer, easily gave up all his responsibilities for fields beyond his vocation, and who even did not see his responsibilities. And when he saw them, and he gives in his memoirs some indication that he saw it at the beginning of 45, and that even it might come to him that he should stop Hitler. And for me and my family personally, when we think that he could have done so, who all would have survived still? When he saw them, did not find any more than the strength in him for at least a very late and the last responsible act of liberation. Or even think of some of our philosophers who, whatever the reasons might have been in particular, failed at least in the beginning for some month, important month, the most important month maybe for the coming up of the whole Third Reich, their responsibilities for the country, some remaining silent, or others even not remaining silent in the first year of the Nazis, I might remind you, on that very great name, Heidegger, who spoke out at Heidelberg University in those days for Hitler. This precondition contributed to the fact, there are of course more reasons, as nationalistic reasons, anti-communist feelings, economical ones, very often analyzed, that in just 1 month, in March 1933, all the democratic rights and the democratic freedoms were destroyed with astonishing ease, without much noticeable resistance or outcries. Freedom of speech, of press, of assembling, of mail, telephone secrecy, protection of home, free disposal of property and movement. All this in that famous Verordnung zum Schutz von Volk und Staat, decree for the protection of folk and state, signed by Paul von Hindenburg after that famous burning of the Reichstag. And then, second, also in March, that fatal identification of all opposition against government and the party, identification with hostility against the nation as such, in the so-called Heimtückegesetz, law of treachery. Always totalitarian regimes, of course, try to make that fatal equation between hostility or opposition to them with opposition to your country, making them by that high treasoners. Third, in the same month, the abolition of all constitutional and parliamentarian restrictions and controls of the government by the so-called Ermächtigungsgesetz, the Enabling Act of March 24, where all the parties, nearly all the parties, even most of the Social Democrats, gave Hitler their yes that he would be for a time out of any control by Parliament, but of course the time lasted then 12 years. And finally, in the very beginning of April 33, that declassification, that discrimination of the Jews by banning all the so-called known Aryans from civil service by the Verordnung zur Wiederherstellung des Berufsbeamtentums, the decree for the restitution of civil service of April 7, which in Dietrich Bonhoeffer's case was already effective to one of his brother-in-law, because in Germany, as you know, all the universities are state universities, and by that all the professors are civil servants, and by that the decree related to them too. This whole tutelizing new legislation was decreed in Germany without public protest, for instance, from the circles of the church all over the country, and not real protest from circles of the universities. The Nazi regime could utilize the support of many leaders out of the churches and out of the German intelligentsia. The still small opposing political intelligentsia either had to keep silent to prepare themselves for an unknown future, maybe political activities, but the majority had just to flee out of the country. And acts of violence here and there against them was either not publicized, not well known, or it did not create any greater reaction in the different bodies of the public life in the country. Instead, for instance, bishops and someone who are very famous now for their later resistance in those days helped to praise the uniqueness of this non-violent and legal revolution. And notice, it was one of Hitler's most skillful formulations he has invented. The Germans always had certain inferiority complexes, because you and the British and the French, they all had their glorious revolutions, and we never had one. Now he gave one us first, and he satisfied all our deep-seated desires to be legal, to be non-violent, and have a revolution. So he called it himself. This was a legal, non-violent revolution, and some of us took that up. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who in those days was a very young pastor and a very young assistant professor at Berlin University, and therefore, of course, of no influence, has attacked at once the last of these four mentioned decrees, that last fatal one, thinking that it was the worst of all the four, and that it was the one which fell under the responsibility of a theologian and of a churchman. And he lectured about it and could even publish, still in June 33, an article in German periodical. So, note, Bonhoeffer himself confined still himself to the realm which was really touching the church, and reacted to, not really politically already, or to the more political decrees of that March 33. And this leads us to this important observation that we have to differentiate between two quite distinct phases of Bonhoeffer's resistance against the totalitarian state, the tyranny of Hitler. In both cases, of course, with different methods, with different goals. First, that pure church-orientated opposition to the Nazification of the churches, which was attempted heavily, and second, the much later political conspiratorial activities. Both interesting enough in their own right, but a mirror too of that old dichotomy in German tradition, and I think having become a tradition in other countries in the meantime too, which by now is familiar to other regions. The church opposition, in which Bonhoeffer took part from the very beginning, with that very early utterance to the Jewish question with many friends. This church opposition, in its own declarations, kept strictly to the rule only to build up groups in the church who would resist and should resist the suction of the Nazi homogenization, conformation, adaptation. The German term in those days, everybody knew what that meant, was Gleichschaltung, conformation of all the fields, press, trade unions, political parties, public medias, and so on, and the church then too. Comparing with other groups, trade unions, for instance, or so, the churches, Bonhoeffer's friends, had quite remarkable success in the beginning. In September 33, there were the first 2,000 signatures about a declaration against Nazification of the church. And then the next year, we rose up 6,000 pastors, ministers about, had undersigned in a country where about 18,000 pastors were all over the country. But this number we could never keep up, and we became a very, very small minority later on at the end of the Nazi time. For a totalitarian state, of course, as the Third Reich, this refusal to conform, not to conform in the constitutional realm, with the introducing the Führer principle, making the bishops more as like Führers, and in doctrine, introducing that the German Spring. Hitler was a revelation of God too, to be preached about. This totalitarian state, for the totalitarian, to the refusal to do that, was of course difficult to swallow, and in this way it was a real highly charged politicum, and so reacted all the papers in your country, in England, and so on. They thought this church opposition is very political, and we most of the time protested then and refused to consider it in the same way. And it is the fact that in all recent totalitarian states too, the authorities meet in the church groups, which build up a hard kernel of refusal out of piety or theology, and which are so difficult to destroy entirely. Though politically difficult to grasp, spiritual protest develops a resistant strength which has capabilities to stop at least that growing phenomenon of total stupidity which we have talked about. The religious minority makes then available an inner steering control which remains unreachable for the power holders. As more this steering control is alive, as more it contributes to preserve cells of hope which are needed for the despaired ones in the totalitarian situation. In this field, Bonhoeffer is, even with those limitations I was pointing to and come back to, of pure church opposition, an example how faith may resist the outward steering by the oppressors and can even mediate experiences of freedom in the midst of persecution. But this is only one half of the effects which come from that biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. As you may have heard, the church rallied in 34 in the famous Barmen Synod of end of May in 34 in Barmen, and made that declaration, the famous six sentences, the Declaration of Barmen, drawn up by Karl Barth, and then unanimously voted for by members of all the regional churches, from Bavaria to Schleswig-Holstein, north to south, west to ost, in a remarkable unanimous vote, which was unprecedented in our church history. But in good old Lutheran tradition of that neat separation of the two realms, even this famous synod, now in these six sentences, protesting sharply against the doctrines which made Nazism and the Führer another source of revelation, and protesting against this in the name of the great Reformation, solus Christ, Christ alone. Now, in bringing that to the floor to vote for, the man who introduced that voting, the speaker Hans Asmussen, now pointedly, which we have seen only afterwards, I wonder now why Karl Barth himself didn't protest already in those days, and probably he did not, because it was for him such a great thing that these six sentences came through. And as a young man in those days, was so glad with all my friends that the church had spoken now this way. But later on now, checking what was really being said and why it was possible that even men from Erlangen or Munich, these Lutherans who were so much over against Karl Barth and politicizing the church, why they voted for it. Now the secret I think we could discover when then Hans Asmussen, in his introductory speech, said that this protest against introducing another kind of Führer principle maybe in the church, and against Adolf Hitler, the second revelation source, said only Christ, everybody understood, so not Hitler. Yeah. Pointedly said that this protest did not mean an opposition, now I quote wordly, against the most recent German history of our folk, against our new state, not against our new government. And this was declared in that introductory speech, which was made part of the resolution. That was later on then, of course, forgotten. This was done few days before the great Rome Putsch, when Hitler killed some of his nearest friends, that purge, but with that, other politicians he didn't like too. It has never come clear how many really were killed. And then the Minister of Justice declared this, by Hitler done, was just law. Few weeks before the Dollfuss murder of the Chancellor of Austria, and few months before Hitler was able, after the Reichspräsident Himmler had died, could declare the combination of the office of the Chancellor with the office of the President, and then the title, the Führer, was made official. This voting, of course, did help. This kind of declaration of Asmussen did get to help in unanimous vote for that famous declaration. But it did not help anymore when this confessing church protested from the pulpits against some injustices in public life. And they have done so on several occasions. And I was in the midst of it. I could tell you more about it. On one Sunday, for instance, I vividly remember, have been imprisoned about 700 pastors at once because of a protest which was read from the pulpit against some activities of the Nazi government. But doing this, they were only imprisoned, of course, for a very short time. Doing this did not mean that those pastors or their confessing church was working for a change of political government, of change of the system. No. To plan responsibly for another social structure was unthinkable for us in those days. That meant that in the first years of National Socialism, many Christians declared, as many do today again, and in those days was a battle cry, let the church be the church, over against the attempts to homogenize, to gleichschalten, to conform, yeah? Meant, of course, against that homogenization was then soon experienced as a reversed statement. The slogan, we do not make politics. It's not our fault when outside Germany papers and other people think of us in political terms. This very slogan was then, when I hear now the very Christian leader of the South African Republic in Cape Town making the statement, writing letters to his pastors, let the church be the church. I come to church to hear remission, the forgiveness of sins, the word of Christ, and nothing else. Don't mix up with politics. And we, in our case, with our very sentence, let be the church, became the prisoners of our own convictions when it then all slowly came to our knowledge. The concentration camps, in the beginning only made up under the nice term re-education camps, yeah? And nobody thought in those days already that some of them may have later been turned into nihilation camps. The Kristallnacht, the war, and finally Auschwitz. The name which might never have come to the knowledge of Dietrich Bonhoeffer himself, because he was out of his relations to the sources of backward informations when he was imprisoned in the beginning of 43. And who has known in the beginning of 43 already that name which is now so familiar to everybody of us? Now the price for earlier protests, for actions earlier, which had not materialized, the price now was rising high and higher. The effort to stop the regime was certainly in this totalitarian state, in this one at least, only possible by means of a conspiracy, and this in the midst of war, by hiding, by now doing things in the very point in the very apparatus of the Nazis, by hiding and appearing as a good Nazi, by trying even to contact maybe a man even in the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, a man like Nebel, we met then, who had been even a member of the Einsatzgruppen, and we told him, you must stay there. The conspiracy needed now positions of power in order to know what was going on and to prepare. As we know, it all failed, yeah. But it had come to the point where all the normal values, measures, where all the normal definitions of morals and ethics shifted. What used to be a traitor to his country now became the true patriot. And the noisy patriot had become the true traitor of his country. And what used to be in normal times the violator of all divine laws became the true believer in God. And what used to be the believer who does not mingle in dirty worldly jobs and preserves his white vest, he became unconsciously, objectively, the traitor to the divine command of love. And this exactly is the other half of the history of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who already once had said, still before his actual concrete step in the organized conspiracy which took place in 1940, in a little Bible study in that preacher seminar I was a member of in 37 or 8. There he had said, it sounds very pious, but it is the whole truth. I quote, "We should tell the devil that Jesus has called to himself not the righteous, but sinners, and that we, in defiance of the devil, wish to remain sinners in order to be with Jesus rather than to be righteous with the devil." One day, apparently, then it was clear to Bonhoeffer that even with a face which was not homogenized, gleichgeschaltet, conformed to Nazism, you were made objectively an accomplice of the Crystal Night, of the war, of Auschwitz. And protests from the pulpits, which happened here and there again, even in 43 in Breslau in the Synod of the Confessing Church and by individuals, became verbal flips, had not anymore any weight. There had to be a sacrifice, very different one from the former one, namely now even the sacrifice of reputation. The price had gone up rapidly, because the question was not anymore how to perform an act of instruction, of information, remember the paragraph about stupidity, but to perform before an act of liberation. Though that performance, of course, was too late, though it was being wrecked, or maybe even because it was wrecked, that biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer has become an inextinguishable sign of hope for oppressed people beyond the borders of his country. A sign of encouragement, too, for the fighters for democratic renewal, for that fight which is so tiresome sometimes, which means for those who still expect more from the wisdom of people and their independence of mind than from people's stupidity. And finally, a warning to those who let the price for the process of ongoing liberation raise and raise by their stubborn refusal to change. Now, when one asks, after all, what is the significance of this Christian from Germany regarding this second stage of his resistance against inhuman, destructive, powerful systems. I would say it depends from the perspective in which you look at him. In the sphere of mere politics as such, Boniface's role was not of special significance or superiority, and he did not think himself that he had to bring in political expertise. That was not his métier, his field. There was one moment when his special ecumenical relations were of extraordinary political importance to the conspirators, who, after they had failed again and again, and in their dealings with other countries, had even passed that point when they had promised, "We will stop Hitler before the big war in the West will start," had lost all credibility, then it was important for them that they could have a man with so many ecumenical links, a man of credibility for some allied quarters. And so Dietrich Bonhoeffer went to Geneva to meet Fischer-Tuft in the ecumenical movement, and went to see Bishop Bell in Stockholm and Uppsala in 42 to tell him that the conspiracy was still on, hoping to do something, and that he should inform the British government. But of course, there were others. There were German politicians who had relations more than Dietrich had, most of the time, certainly the more important ones. Under constitutional perspectives, constitutional perspectives for a future democratic Germany, maybe, there are no special written statements, memorandums from Bonhoeffer's hand available. He, in 41, 42, had written a memorandum to his English correspondents from Geneva when he was there about the difficulties to go quickly forward to democratic rules in Germany after an possible overthrow would have taken place. And there are some clear stimulations by him. He stimulated some people for drawing up memoranda directed to several professors of political science, economics, and so on, especially in the famous Freiburg group, von Dietze, von Ritter, and so on. But to do that, he left to people like them. But in the realm of an ethical penetration of the resistance, Bonhoeffer belongs certainly into the first row of the resistors. The strength of his mind, the integrity of his relation to realities, and in a way, I think, the force of his language too enabled him to give expression to the most extraordinary situation, and this in an unforgettable acuteness, partly in the last paragraphs of his ethics, partly in the famous letters and papers from prison. And this expressing that was not done either not in a premature sitting on a study desk and reasoning about it, and not after all, when everybody knows, of course, anyway. But it was written in the midst of the turmoil of action, and in a moment partly when there was great hope that it would happen, then it didn't happen, and it was written in waiting for the gallows. So that the language of the hanged man now speaks so much louder for Germany than the language of the hangman. Finally, in the realm of that long, effective Lutheran Christian tradition, Bonhoeffer has opened up a door out of the ghetto of that non-political Christian faith. For that, of course, he has not only thought and written, but paid the price in a convincing testimony given then in these last letters, in these statements about the man Christ who is there for others. And that means a breakthrough, a real breakthrough through a long history of education, education that you should limit yourself to your duties, to your vocation in administrative, in military field, with the lawyers, with the politicians, and more so with the churchmen, who had by that lost their sense of responsibility for the whole of society, and which then resulted in giving up even the responsibility for the work in the realm of their own profession, as one could explain, and making them totale Befehlsempfänger, receivers only of commands and doing what is given to them in these commands. Hitler was one problem for us. What made him possible, and what might make another time one possible, that is the other problem. And therefore, we need remembering figures like Bonhoeffer. There had come out recently a book by a Dutch theologian and writer, Rothusen. He has given this book a very fatal title, and that title says in German, Die Speers bleiben. The spears remain, they stay. That's the problem. And now again, Bonhoeffer in his whole life was very much driven to concretize and experiment what he was believing in. So before the totalitarian state came up, he thought he had to concretize his faith in something which was very unfamiliar in German circles, and especially in German church circles. He thought he had to concretize and experiment his faith in the question of peace. And that made him very unpopular and made him an ally in those early years of the pacifists. But then came the totalitarian state, and then came that ideology of racism. And the ideology of this totalitarian state, namely the superiority of the Aryan elite and its messianic execution and escalation in destroying the Jews in the name of all the Aryans, in our own name, that was not anymore responded to by preaching pacifism and by acting out pacifism. That simply did not apply. You were evading a whole field of your responsibilities, and so something else had to be done. And so the preacher of peace had become an ally of the conspirators who tried to get liberation from the murderers. To have seen his accountability on this risky level and to have asked it makes Bonhoeffer as a Christian minister in Germany in a way unique. And just let me point, in his whole dealing in these years, there was a third field in which he had began to concretize already. In a painful new learning process, Bonhoeffer saw in the third stage, on the third level, the coming transformation of Christianity. A liberation for the church by her own return to poverty, by her stepping down from the positions of dominance, maybe in hierarchical, maybe in theological terms, in juridical, in economical terms, down to the way of Christ amongst men. Bonhoeffer must have had a presentiment in what way and to what an extent the ethics of an alliance with the injured and suppressed ones would become the controversial theme of today's Christianity, maybe in so-called Christian democratic nations, maybe in the same way, at the same time, in parts of the world where Christianity is now under totalitarian tutelage oppressed. Let me close these remarks with one quotation out of his last years, which was meant to be included in that essay after 10 years for his friends. their Bonifaces. It remains an experience of incomparable value that for once we have learned to see the great events of world history from below, from the perspective of those who are excluded, suspected, mistreated, powerless, oppressed, mocked, and despised. In short, from the perspective of those who suffer. If only in such a time bitterness or envy will not have devoured the heart, so that we can see the important and the unimportant, fortune and misfortune, strength and weakness with new eyes, so that our perception of the significant of humanity, of justice, of mercy, has become clearer, freer, less corruptible. Yes, so that we can see that personal suffering is a more useful key, a more fruitful principle for viewing and actively understanding the world than is personal happiness. It is, of course, necessary that this perspective from below does not become a partisan matter on behalf of the eternally dissatisfied, but that we do justice to and affirm life in all its dimensions from the perspective of a higher satisfaction, which actually derives from a basis beyond what is above and what is below. Thank you.
I have explained to our speaker that we have a custom of asking questions after our lectures, and he's quite happy to answer any that you would like to put. Question, or would you like to repeat
would be very helpful for me too.
Well, I don't know that I have it exactly, but the lady would like to know if the nature of the German people has changed since the Second World War, so that they are now taking a greater understanding and appreciation of international attitudes rather than they did during the war. Is that
about, yeah? I think I should make two remarks to that. First of all, I would say we have changed. We have changed, I can express it negatively. You will not find in the majority of young people in Germany, in the great majority of people in the 30s and the 40s and so on, any left feeling of nationalism. This is, of course, ambiguous in a way, yeah? But to fight for nationalism as in 33, 34, and even 40, many were prepared to, yeah? There's not any preparedness for that left, I think. Only very, very small groups of neo-Nazis are there who are preaching and are even able to interest some youngsters who find that exciting, yeah? But in the great majority, to revive now any new nationalism in Germans, I think is, for the time being, impossible. This is expressed rather negatively. Second, I would try and dare to say that in contrast to the 20s, to the Weimar Republic, when in the Weimar Republic there was a considerable amount of bourgeois, and especially in my own field, the great majority of clergy was, of course, not at all democratically trained or thinking in democratic terms, and were totally opposed to the regime of the Weimar Republic. I think most of the Germans, whether they do it skillfully or not, are now convinced Democrats and try to learn the game of balancing powers. And in some fields, I cannot go too much into the details, we succeed. Yeah. So this points to the yes to your question. On the other hand, to change a 400-year-old history, I say 400 years, referring to my own Lutheran background, to change totally theology and ideology, yeah, to put out that thinking in two realms this fatal way, in one generation is nearly impossible. And I found it personally rather dangerous when Strauss and Kohl in the last election, to the last West German elections on the 3rd of October, when it was before you, I'm not in America, I'm sorry. Before the last election, when they were playing so much again with some of these elements of our revered but fatal past. Yeah. So be patient if you can.
Thank you. Dr. Keith?
The world today is witness to a great many oppressions in many countries. To speak only of the USSR, Uganda, Chile, and others. At the same time, it is a custom in international jurisdictions to claim there shall be no interference in the affairs of another country. To what extent, in the light of your experience and your views, do you think this principle is valid today?
May I just repeat for the benefit of the rest of the audience, Dr. Cates says that there's a great deal of oppression going on in various parts of the world today, USSR, Russia, Uganda, and so forth, and that and the policy is hands off. And whether that is considered to be a good thing or not by our guest speaker.
Let me say first, I'm not a political scientist, so I might be not too educated in these fields. I have the impression it depends from the timing to have a total principle, either or, black and white. One can argue for the one side and argue for the other side. I think it's not too good to have a clear-cut answer to your question. I have the feeling in the first 2 or 3 years of Hitler, another attitude of the foreign powers would have had some effect. Later on, not anymore. And there are times in which, for instance, in the church sphere, there are minorities of the churches in some countries who ask us now to speak out. And it is actually of great help to do that. Not shying away from it and say it doesn't, we have not to interfere, yeah? But there are other cases which I can give you examples from my own experiences with my friends in East Germany, where I go every year and have even members of my family and have old friends who themselves in certain cases say, don't speak out. You make us a fifth column in that other part of the world. And if you are not already in the stage of conspiracy or something like that, we have to stand and not appearing as the fifth colony of the capitalist West. Yeah? Though I know of cases where we are asked by men inside such a country to speak out where it's helpful. I think for buyers nowadays in South Africa, we cannot do better as speak out and speak out, speak out as often as possible. And for some others, Manus Buthelezi and what their names all is, yeah? But in the case of my friend, the bishop in East Berlin now, I would be much more careful because I have the feeling they up to now stand for their case and they do certain things and we would destroy the very things they do by speaking too much and too loud in their cases. Only half an answer or a quarter or a third of an answer.
Yes.
Dr. Baitke, from your experience, first-hand experience, and now your hindsight, how long would the German people have been able to stand what was going on, and how long before there would have been any changes of the regime, do you think, had there not been a war that intervened?
Will you repeat it?
When I understood rightly, the question was how long were people in Germany in the beginning, how long would they have been able to protest, to resist, yeah, to change?
How long before?
Yeah.
Had there been no intervention? Through war?
How long before there would have been a revolution in Germany if no war had intervened against Hitler?
Against Hitler. As far as my knowledge and my first-hand knowledge goes, the organizational form of political underground resistance, conspiracy, started exactly in February 38, after the case of General Fritsch, who was put out by Hitler because he felt his unreliability for him, accusing him for homosexuality and so on. And then there were certain men in the army and in the Ministry of Justice. One was the brother-in-law of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, through whom Dietrich Bonhoeffer was so well informed, who tried to use this case to find people in powerful positions, especially generals, now to protest, to stop Hitler. Yeah? That was the very beginning of the same organization, which was changing, of course, in the years, which very, very late came into the open, the 20th of July, 44. Is that answering your question in a way, or? Yeah, yeah. But I cannot imagine any totalitarian state without a second level under the official level where all kinds of bribery and all kinds of deceit and so is going on and where you... yeah, it's never total.
Yes, sir. professor. The question was whether the speaker would like to compare Martin Niemöller, the other great Lutheran clergyman, with Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Yeah. You might remember that Martin Niemöller was put into prison on the 1st of July, 37. Dietrich Bonhoeffer and me, we happened to be in his house on the very day he was imprisoned, which means that we were totally one of them up to the very day he was then put out of action. And then he became, as a prisoner of the Confessing Church, that great symbol all over the world. Yeah, but that was clearly the time when even Dietrich Bonhoeffer didn't think that the church, or he as a churchman, a pastor, should do the stopping of Hitler. And the organized, planned, responsibly planned conspiracy, as I said, started only later in 38. So Martin Niemöller himself was never put into the situation of an option to act in the church or act politically. He opposed. He was the man who was preaching and who was saying the truth from the pulpit, but never said anything once that we should change the government or make plans to put that out of business and another in. Yeah. So Martin Niemöller's own time of freedom, of movement, yeah? After the war, in the late 50s, or was even in the beginning of the 60s, I had once a discussion with him where he said probably he would not have done what Dietrich Bonhoeffer had done because of his Lutheran background. Whether he would say so today, he is still a great prophet. And now he's again what I suppose Dietrich Bonhoeffer would have been. Again, he's a great prophet for the peace movement. And even he said, if I wouldn't depend now in my 86th year from the pension of my church, I would become a Quaker.
Totalitarianism, yeah.
By people who become totally involved in their own fields and do not look beyond. Do you think this is in danger of happening today? And if so, how can it be overcome? Do you think that people are too involved in their own fields to see what's happening around them?
The lady's question is that, if I understand it properly, that over specialization in one's own field is an encouragement to totalitarianism.
I would simply say yes, that is so. It depends, of course, it's not the only element in it. But when one government is able to destroy the, you call that, check and balance. Then the danger is just in this field, because you seem to be so honest, so you do a good job, and it is really not your job why it is being done or so, and then it becomes an escapism. Yeah, it's so very difficult to talk about the things others do, and you can be defeated so easily. You have not the knowledge so exact about it, yeah? And that whole field of common responsibility is controversial, yeah? But it is the very temptation in all kinds of power, becoming superpowers. Yeah. Then they make you feel well because they give you medals and praise, public praise for your wonderful job you do, and that's tempting, and you do wonderful jobs. You are the first in the world in this and that field. Yeah. I think in my own German experience, what we in the church have to fight against primarily in Germany is keep the medias in several hands. Never give them into one hand. Have always many sources of information. Have controversies. Learn to struggle and to fight out struggles. In our tradition, unity always was the first thing. And who was fighting for inner political concerns, social liberties or so, he was always defeated, morally defeated, by saying, you are destroying the unity, by that the strength of Germany, all of the country. Yeah? And when that is happening, danger is coming up.
Had Hitler been able to do what he was doing, not by totalitarian, but by democratic means, what then would have been the attitude of the church?
As far as I can understand your question, I think that's impossible. Hitler could not have done anything with democratic means, because the ideology was basic that there was a superiority of these Aryan race, and that was the motivation, that was the compelling spring out of which everything else came. He could not allow any kind of democratic means, when you mean what you say democratic means. Or did I not understand quite well what you really are asking for? You mean that his deceit could go so far that he could become a democratic leader? What do you think about Nixon or so? Or yeah, the monopoly, that's the great danger. But wherever monopolizing activities succeed, the democratic state is ceasing to exist. Isn't that true, or are you often, have you another opinion? Oh yeah, I have great experience in voting in a totalitarian state. We voted every year. Are you for including Austria into Germany, or are you against it? We voted in 1938. Yeah. Yeah, but then you must have an option in more parties. Yeah. In East Germany, the Russians did. They introduced their. Einheitspartei, and then they allowed a Bauern Liberal Democrat Partei, and they allowed a Christian Democratic Partei party. But everybody saw what it was. Yeah, they were just masks. Yeah, very small units who themselves declared policy making is left only to the Communist Party itself. Yeah, so. It was an interesting attempt, but nobody believed that that was democracy. Yeah?
So in a genuinely democratic state, one party were elected on platforms saying exterminating a certain minority. The democratically elected to do that would seem to do so.
Yeah, but I mean, the constitution must be done this way, that in democratically voted in majority, more than 50%, you mean, yeah? That could not stay forever, that they have to expose themselves after certain years again to election, yeah? And it might happen that the Christian Democrats in 1980 get 51%. I'm not looking forward to that, but I look then forward to the next, after the next 4 years, and I'm sure they will not get again 51%. So,
Can I just interpret that? The speaker is suggesting a parallel between the Nazis getting financial support in their rise to power and Brazil getting assistance from Germany of a nuclear power plant.
You may know that I came to this, to America, to the United States in the beginning of September, and up to that time it was not already public discussion, as it is apparently now, very much so, public discussion. And to say you a word about the opinion of the church, I'm not in the position to do so. I know that this is very controversial, and there are parts in the church who are appalled, is that an English word? Appalled by the support we give to South Africa, to Brazil and so. And there are other parts who are trying to deal with the big industrialists in our country to come to an opinion. We have even a commission now, commissioned by the Rat, the Council of the German Evangelical Church in Germany, of the whole, to deal with support, especially South African industry. And so, and the investments there, yeah, and that's dragging along and along and along and along, dragging along, and, yeah. And the I know that in this very commission, the fight itself is being fought out. So, at the moment, there's no clear-cut answer has appeared.
And the general effect of a parallel is not accepted.
Of a parallel? No, no. That there are parallels, many would agree. More so, I think, in South Africa than in Brazil. South Africa has an ideology too, much more than Brazil's have. I don't deny that in Brazil, horrible things happen.
Germany had so many clever generals and ingenious technicians and dedicated churchmen. Why did it require such a large conspiracy rather than a few dedicated people to remove one man?
Did you get that? Dr. Vogt wants to know why there was so many brilliant people in Germany, they needed a large conspiracy, why they couldn't do it without a small conspiracy.
And succeed in a year.
And succeed in a year rather than take 6 years.
In the beginning, of course, that organized conspiracy was very small. As much longer, as years went on and on and on, more people came in, and maybe the mistake of the German conspiracy was that there were not real revolutionaries in that camp. They were all decent fathers of 3-4 children with a good name in their fields, in all the different fields. And there were even, yes, there were socialists, were in Labour, Mierendorf, and so on and so on. And but when they did not succeed, first time they tried to stop him, and we had great hope that it would really happen, was in September 38 already, when we all thought that would mean war, Czechoslovakian crisis, yeah. And then Hitler with Munich came out with that great success, and that was a great disappointment for the man who knew, yeah, but that was a rather small group. Then the second wave of hopes in our groups came in the winter of 39-40, after Poland, late enough, because people who knew what had happened in Poland found it already too late, but the whole world conscience didn't know too much already in those days what the first Einsatzgruppen had done in Poland, yeah, and why Blaskowitz, the governor of the German army in Poland, had resigned. Yeah. Then there was some hope to stop Hitler. Then France, the great victory. Who could then ask a general who got big estates and big new titles and all that? That great success asked now to make this tap in the back, yeah? Then there was a rather small group of mainly civilians who kept on, yeah? Saying, that's impossible, we must stop him. Then the next wave was 42, 43. In 43, the beginning, there were made two attempts on Hitler lives, which failed. Once the explosive didn't explode, and the other time, the man who was prepared to do it. In Hitler was going around in a museum displaying of Russian weapons and so. He was planned to come to that point where that man was maybe, let's say, 12:10, and Hitler came, first of all, to the whole display half an hour earlier and disappeared only after a few minutes. So he never came to that point, yeah? And these kind of things, or then in late 43, another attempt when the... These are the attempts I know about. Some few young officers were, as an honor, asked to show Hitler new uniforms. That was a great honor to be selected into that group. And under them happened to be two of our men who were prepared now to do it. And in the night before the British and the American airplanes made one of the heaviest night air raids on Berlin, and the very house in which these uniforms all were placed in totally burned out. And the whole display of uniforms was postponed another month, and in that second time, these two officers were not included. It was a different go, yeah? And these kind of things happened again and again. Now, why? And in the meantime, by this feeling for responsibility in to make a plot in the war, the most unpatriotic thing for normal people you can think of, yeah, they had of course to do everything to make as sure as possible the transition after killing Hitler, to take over the radio station, to the government, the police station, and to imprison certain SS people and all that, yeah, and when you start that. Of course, more and more and more fields come into your mind as responsibly thinking, and you could find people who would accept the responsibility for that. And then only by that you can understand that after the failure and the real things have come into the open, that Hitler killed right out of their membership, close or not so close membership in the conspiracy, 5,000 people. That would have not been the case in 42, and not so in 40, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Do you think that the churches of the world have really benefited by the German experience?
Do you think the churches of the world have benefited by the German experience?
Many churches now understand more that the opposition of the German church was not as simple as it seems now. We have never been real heroes, and now they discover that too. How difficult things are actually at the spot. There's no, what we know now was then only known or said by very few, and then everybody said, oh, how can you say so? Yeah, Hitler might disappear in a few months. He runs into difficulties. Yeah. Or why do you take that Jewish question so important? Of course, this anti-Semitism we don't like really, but that's one of the side effects that will die out. That was said in 34, 33. And there's even now a Jewish professor in Erlangen, Professor Schöps. He's a Jew, professor there. He says, who says that in 35, everybody could have known is a liar. And he belonged to a group of Jews who have gone have made an request in 34 or so, or 33, to the party to allow a Jewish SR. It's unbelievable, but it's so. Yeah. I tell that only to say that in face of the problems before, it's not as simple. So to learn from the German experience is now in South Africa, many people say, we learn from the confessing church, let the church be the church. Not realizing that the same truth expressed in other times is the opposite of the truth it has been. By the same very words. I hope you understand that.
Could I just say, for the benefit of the rest of the audience, you're comparing, or some local politicians comparing the Canada today to the Weimar Republic in 1930, just before Hitler came in, and the question of unity and separatism was ripe at that time there. That's that a fair statement?
Yeah. You must allow me to say that I'm first time in your country in reading a little bit of your papers and speaking to people here. I've been 20 years ago just on a visit in Quebec, and I like the French onion soup more than anything else. but that was all. And now, to give a judgment whether your situation now you can compare with about 30 or 31 in Germany, I would not dare to do that. I can only tell you, two nights or three nights ago, I was asked by your local new station, television station, to come, Vancouver or what's called, 729, yeah? And it happened to be that I was sitting next to one of your people who speak out for Levesque, is that properly pronounced? Yeah?
Levesque.
And has written a book now with for me, a very provocative title, a word which in Germany would put you were totally to contempt to say so. Separatism. And I talked with him about him. It was very nice and friendly, and that came out that this is a battle word, of course, now, and that it's not by him, and not, as far as I understood, by Mr. Levesque too, not meant that he would leave Canada. He would leave the present federation, but that never would mean to leave Canada. But now I speak about things I'm totally unschuldig. I mustn't go on to do that. But as far as I can see now, it is an underrating of the seriousness in Germany with the coming Nazis when you compare that with your situation here. I don't see this kind of discriminating, dehumanizing ideology coming up with execution, with executing that ideology. You fight about being French or English, and why shouldn't you do that?
I think, Professor, that Mr. Levesque doesn't know very much what separatism is either.
Yes?
At what particular point did the churches in Germany realize that those camps were
When did the German church find out about the true nature of the concentration camps, and then why didn't somebody make an outcry?
First of all, I would like to differentiate what is the true nature of the concentration camp. I don't want to justify any kind of concentration camp, of course, but in up to 38-39, the concentration camp, I think every Nazi could argue this way, and all the sources would, all the documents would show, they were not meant to be extermination camps. They were meant in the beginning to change communists and socialists by a rough education. And of course, that was not in hospital, and we know what happened to Ossietzky and some other people who died already then, yeah, by mistreatment and even by tortures and all that. That happened. And I have two very close friends who have been in the concentration camp from 36 to 38. So I know what it was like in those days. But I think we make a mistake when we already, our picture we have now from Auschwitz totally equate with that picture. Now, I can assure you that the confessing church, the opposition church, in 36 sent a memorandum to Hitler, and making one of the points, other points were about education and so, about mistreatment and dehumanizing people by these very concentration camps without trial and so, yeah? They made a point. Not very strong, but they did. And when Hitler didn't answer, and by a certain accident, that memorandum was being published in Basel first, in a Swiss paper, then in an English paper, then they made a declaration from the pulpits in August 36, where many, many pastors read a form of that bigger memorandum. Unfortunately, they left out that little paragraph about the Jews especially, yeah? But they said something about where everybody understood that's to the point of concentration camp. In 38, when the Kristallnacht happened, it's a long story now, the confessing church was so weak, they had gone through 38 to humiliating experiences, and they were really silent, it's true. And when in the, you know, the Wannsee Conference now, the Wannsee Conference in the beginning of 41, when Heydrich, the second man after Himmler, drew up gave all the details, what was drawn up now for extinguishing destructive camps, yeah? To all the different ministries of the army and administration and so on. The Germans did not know that, of course. They could have known if someone of these many people in the Ministry of Justice have told them, yeah? But then we were already so tired and out, we did, in fact, not do much. But even in 43-44, the Nazis themselves made the difference between concentration camps and annihilation camps. They themselves made it. Now, our picture, quite rightly, of course, is totally made up by the very last, the name of Auschwitz. That now stands for everything. And in fact, first discriminating, then separating the Jews from us, and then, only then, killing them. Yeah, that were the escalation, yeah? So, the first concentration camps, of course, we see now how much they were in line to the whole thing. And this is, of course, the remaining thing. I was on a Holocaust conference last week in San Jose, and I sat there with my wife, and 2 days, historians, Jewish, some Christian, for 2 days, they talked all the time, Germans, and described what the SS had done, and never differentiated between Nazis and Germans. and had to go through what in 44, 45, 45 to us was quite clear, that the world has great difficulties to differentiate, and that we have to endure it.
The brown houses in 1933 and 34.
What do you call now brown houses? I mean, there was one Das Braune Haus in Munich, that was the headquarters of the party. You mean?
There was police
quarters. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was that great murder in greater numbers, of course, on the Röhmputsch. On the 30th of June in 34. But that there was mass killing going on already, I am not aware in the moment that was in 33, 34, 35 already going on. Beating up, torture, something like that happened. Yeah.
Yeah, this one, please. This gentleman is first, I think, if you don't mind.
I
fail to understand how a follower of the Christian Messiah could advocate the destruction of another human being. I can understand Bonhoeffer becoming an atheist and advocating the death of Hitler, but to do so and remain a Christian puzzles me. Can you comment on this?
The question is, speaker fails to understand why a Christian such as Bonhoeffer would recommend the annihilation of another human being, even though it be Hitler, without becoming an atheist himself.
How can you remain a Christian when around you a lot of your co-citizens are first discriminated in your name, then separated, and then gassed? How can you say, I'm a Christian, I don't go to stop that man, I'm a Christian, I want to have the white vest, I would claim this is not a Christian anymore?
I think that we've given a lot of questions to our guest. I think we ought to arrest him now. I'm going to ask Dr. Houston, of the principal of Regent College, to express our thanks to a speaker.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've already expressed your vote of thanks twice over this evening to our distinguished speaker, but I want to articulate, I think, on your behalf, two other reasons why we are so grateful that he's come to us this evening. And we do thank him for his clarity and the illumination with which he's spoken to us. And it's very easy for us sitting in our comfortable chairs to enjoy all this. And yet, I think that we also want to be remembered that it was ordinary people, simple people, people with integrity, however, and with a sense of... And so it was a very different picture at the end of the war when men like Dietrich Bonhoeffer went to prison, when indeed our speaker went to prison, when indeed Mrs. Bethke, who is here with us this evening in the audience, when her father was executed, her uncle was executed, her cousin was executed, all within a short time just before the end of the war. And all because they believed in freedom, all because they believed in the integrity of justice. And so we do want, I think, this evening to pay our tribute to both Dr. and Mrs. Bethgay for all that they have gone through. And what is a creed de coeur that we've heard from him this evening is also the fact that he still bears so often the criticism and the guilt which is not his, but which he resisted. And I think he's also reminded us this evening that it is easy for us in the lifestyle that we have to be seduced by the same kind of stupidity that he talked about this evening. I think we should remember that one of the things that is such a blindness to us all is professionalism, which so often in its intense specialization has its own inbuilt buck-passing system so that somebody else can carry their moral responsibility and decision, because that's not our speciality. And I think, too, we realize that one of the great needs of our society today is the recovery of wisdom. We have knowledge, we have information, but how wise are we? And that's a wisdom that goes with humility, that goes with a fear of God, that also goes with a love of justice. And so, Dr. Bethgay and Mrs. Bethgay, we do applaud you this evening and thank you for what you've done.
Ladies and gentlemen, please come again next week when we'll go into the very heady atmosphere of mesons, protons, and itons with Dr. Eric Vogt.